Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio's Home Edition, recorded live to tape via Skype from our home-based studios on this date, October 27th, 2020. An added caveat for today's Friday edition, I recorded this program in 2011, just weeks before the murder of Libyan revolutionary and longtime national leader Muammar Gaddafi. Colonel Gaddafi's Libya was attacked by NATO forces 9 years ago, and he murdered by NATO-supported fighters, cornered, mobbed, and stabbed to death in the most gruesome fashion. More vile, though, than the facts of Gaddafi's slaughter is the fate of his country since. Once the richest country in Africa, benefactor to its neighbors, and dedicated to pan-Africanism, Libya is today a wrecked and war-torn disaster. Con Hallinan is an American educator and independent journalist. Hallinan is a columnist at Foreign Policy in Focus and author of the news analysis site Dispatches from the Edge, where he bravely opposed the accepted wisdom of the time, writing Juan Cole, 10 Myths About Libya, challenging the University of Michigan professor's support for NATO's intervention in Libya. Con Hallinan and getting behind the myths of the destruction of the Gaddafi regime in the first half. And in January of 2011, the legendary journalist and author John Ross died in Mexico. John Ross, rebel to the roots in the second half. And CFUV radio broadcaster and host of Plant-Powered Radio, Janine Bancroft, will join us at the bottom of the hour with the Left Coast Events Bulletin of some of the good things to be gotten up to in and around our town and virtually for the coming week. But first, Con Hallinan and a Libyan regime change rejoinder.
Well, it's a storyline as familiar as a Roman numeraled summer sequel. Evil dictator targeting own people must be stopped. International law and order, just so much red tape. Immediate action must take precedence. Cue the Top Guns, ramp up the music. And so it was Muammar Gaddafi, a bad guy no matter which way you spell it, has seen his 42-year reign in Libya come crashing to the ground. While the Hitler of North Africa is absent his bunker, no doubt he'll be hunted down and smoked out of his spidey hole soon. And should he survive the dead or alive, but preferably dead, price put on his head, he can expect no better victor's justice than received by his evil predecessor Saddam, Hitler of Babylon, a long drop at the end of a short rope. Another great victory for NATO and triumph for democracy. Or is it? Well, welcome back to the program, Con.
Well, I'm glad to have me back, Chris. I'm happy to hear.
Well, my great pleasure. Now, Con, I've been critical, contemptuously so, some say, of NATO's latest invasion. My detractors say that I'm a heartless monster that would allow Colonel Gaddafi murder his own people. Should I now be contrite and jump on the victorious rebel bandwagon, Con?
I would be a little careful about jumping on that bandwagon. You're not sure exactly where it's going to go. There's an interesting piece in yesterday's Asia Times by Pepe Escobar, who writes about this region of the world. He's a particular expert on oil, and he's been tracking down some of the people who are the leading part of this transitional government's military wing. And it turns out where most of them are from is that they came out of the Mujahideen in Afghanistan and are very closely associated with Al-Qaeda, if Al-Qaeda really exists in the traditional sense of the word. But they tend to be fundamentalists. They tend to be very close to the Muslim Brotherhood. I would be a little careful about what we're celebrating here. We really don't know who these people are, and I think that your response to the invasion, which I initially called the attack of the Keystone Crusaders, was that it was not thought through and that it was a mess. I am no admirer of Muammar Gaddafi. At the same time, I think this war had a possibility of being avoided, and there was no effort to do so. And that once the French and the British and the U.S. got the United Nations Resolution 1973 passed to protect the civilian population, they immediately morphed it into regime change. And that's one of the reasons why the war went on for almost 6 months, because essentially Gaddafi was going to make it a fight to the death. It was going to be regime change, and he was being charged as a war criminal. Well, then he was going to fight to the death. One note that people should know is that there's a rumor now that he and his family are in Algeria. That's not confirmed, but or at least it wasn't confirmed the last time I saw it. But apparently he's gotten out of town at this point.
Well, I have heard about Algeria. I heard that his wife and a couple of his children were confirmed to be in Algeria, though the Algerian government was reluctant to admit that at first. As for Muammar, where he is at this hour, I don't know. But you've been around a long time, Con, and maybe not quite as long as Gaddafi, but just from reading his character and his history, do you think that he would try to go to Algeria or any other place rather than stand and fight and be buried in the sands of Libya?
You know, trying to figure out Muammar Gaddafi is, I think, more art than science, Chris. He's a very odd guy. I mean, he's an extremely odd guy. And, you know, there's no question that a lot of the things that he did, particularly in terms of opposition within Libya and things like that, were really awful. I mean, he did unleash troops on his own people. He did kill a fair number of people. But I think that, you know, when you start comparing Gaddafi with someone like Hussein, you know, who massacred vast numbers of Kurds and who, you know, absolutely liquidated any opposition from the country, I think it's a bit of a stretch. And it also, one of the things that Juan Cole does in his thing about why we should support the war in Libya is that he says, you know, Libya's always played this very sinister role in Africa, and that's just actually not factually the case. They certainly, Gaddafi certainly did encourage in civil wars, for instance, in Chad and to a certain extent in northern Nigeria, but he also, Libya financed the formation of the African Bank, which allowed the African countries to avoid the sort of tender mercies of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank and be able to borrow money without having to go through massive austerity cutbacks. And they also funded an African telecommunications system, which allowed the African countries to save a lot of money by not using Western telecommunications companies. Now, I'm not presenting this as, look, Gaddafi was a good guy, we overthrew this good guy. I mean, he shouldn't be in power for 42 years. You know, when you're in power for 42 years, something's wrong. But I think what I'm trying to say here is that people need to ask, why Libya? I mean, why did NATO and the U.S. go into Libya? And to kind of pull the lens back a little bit and to try and see this as really a strategy that was laid out by the Heritage Foundation, which ought to scare you to death, way back in 2003. And then actually what's happened is that it's pretty much followed the recommendations of the Heritage Foundation.
And who are they, Con?
The Heritage Foundation is one of the most conservative, one of the most right-wing of the Washington think tanks. It was it is associated, it's largely funded by the Shafley Foundation and by Joseph Coors. So it gives you an idea. This is, I would say, the right of the right is the Heritage Foundation, more to the right than something like the American Enterprise Institute. They played a very important role in the Bush administration. And very early, back in 2003, they drew up a kind of a blueprint. And the blueprint was based on the fact that the United States had to get back into Africa. And that the reason why they had to do so was because Africa was extremely rich in resources that were important, strategic, to the United States. Everything from rare earth elements to oil and gas. Particularly oil and gas. I mean, by 15-25% of our oil will be imported from Africa. So this is a major source now for American energy companies. And what they suggested is that one, the Americans form what they call an African command. People may not realize, but the United States has the world divided up into military commands. SOUTHCOM, for instance, is Latin America and the Caribbean. CENTCOM is the Middle East. PACCOM is the Pacific Ocean. Then there's NORTHCOM, which is Europe, etc. But there was never a military formation for Africa. So they did. They started an organization called AFRICOM, African Command. It doesn't yet have a base in Africa because no African country will allow it to set up a base, although I think they'll get one now.
And probably in Libya, too.
And to set up this AFRICOM and then to find a place to intervene with the military, not using troops, only using airplanes and Navy, which is what the Libya intervention was, and to not do it alone, but to do it with allies. And, of course, we had the French and the British were major allies, and there were a couple of other countries that were directly involved. And the purpose was to ensure access to strategic resources, particularly since China has made an enormous kind of full-court press on trying to lock up resources in the African continent. So I think if you look at Libya in that way, and you see it as the first NATO operation in Africa, and you see it as a kind of a message to the rest of Africa, then I think you get a somewhat different strategic spin on what this war was about and also what it means for the future, which, of course, is pretty unclear at this point.
Yeah, well, I mean, we can really get easily caught up in the why Libya, why now, why Gaddafi. Well, it sounds to me that the United States and its allies in NATO, they were going into Africa regardless. What we've seen in North Africa in these last months, I don't think is quite as spontaneous and quite as people-powered as the press would have us believe. But I mean, this is just the next domino in taking control of Africa and her resources?
Well, I do think that that's a strong possibility, and I always have to be careful about making predictions. But I do think it's a strong possibility, and there's a kind of a track record for it. Back in 2006, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization pulled together a series of military exercises in the Gulf of Guinea, actually in the Cape Verde Islands. And the purpose of the exercise was a military intervention in case of a civil disturbance in the Gulf of Guinea, which would have an impact on oil supplies. Now, what we're talking about in the Gulf of Guinea is Nigeria, which is, of course, the largest of them, but also Angola, Equatorial Guinea. There are a number of countries that are very important in the Gulf of Guinea, and we have large amounts of oil that come out of that area. So we did this operation to sort of to war game the possible intervention. Now, if you look at the Gulf of Guinea right now, there are a number of instabilities and possible things which people should concern themselves about. The Niger Delta has a kind of an ongoing low-level guerrilla war with the Niger Delta people against the central government over the question of control of oil resources in the Nile Delta and the fact that people in the Delta are not getting any money out of the fact that all this oil is being taken out, and they also have to suffer a tremendous amount of pollution, etc. There's also a low-level guerrilla war going on in the northern part of Nigeria between the Tuareg people who are in Mali and Chad and northern Nigeria, Sahara people, over the fact that the Nigerian government has kind of put the clamps on uranium deposits, which they're mining for French uranium companies. And then there's this recent bombing, of course, that happened in the Nigerian capital, which the New York Times is talking about as being al-Qaeda-related and all this kind of stuff. And so what you're seeing here is a kind of a pattern. Back in 2000 and the United States started something called the Trans-Sahel Anti-Terrorist Initiative, and it was to train troops in the Sahara area to fight terrorism. There wasn't any terrorism in 2003, and now here we are. We're in Somalia, mm-hmm. we're in Djibouti in the Horn of Africa. We're in Ethiopia. We're across the Red Sea in Yemen. We're now in Libya, and we have this military presence in the Gulf of Guinea. So I think what people need to ask themselves is where is this going? And just to add one small thing to that, one of the things that the Obama administration has done is that they have kind of shifted away from this idea of big military invasions and formations, Iraq, Afghanistan, etc. And they've been elevating these special forces commanders into sort of mainstream military commands in the Pentagon. So SOUTHCOM for Latin America has a bunch of special forces now. And CENTCOM that covers the Middle East has a bunch of special forces. AFRICOM has a bunch of special forces. Special forces, by definition, work in the dark. You know, they don't tell you what they're doing. That's why they're special forces. And so I see that there's a kind of move away from having congressional and civilian control over what our military is doing. Mm-hmm. And instead, this kind of stepping up of what I'd have to call sort of hidden warfare, the drone war in Somalia, the drone war in Yemen, the drone war in Pakistan, and now the fact that the Obama administration maintains that what we did in Libya is not a war. Certainly seems to me to be a war, but according to the administration, it's not. That's where I think people should be concerned. I think what we're doing is that we're starting to lose control over what it is that our military does, and that should concern people.
Well, yeah, and who controls the military or who is controlled by it in the United States. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio on CFUV 101.9 FM, 104.3 on the cable, and CFUV.uvic.ca on the internet, everywhere else in Shoutcast. I'm speaking tonight with Con Hallinan, and Con is an American educator and independent journalist. He ran the program at the University of California at Santa Cruz for 20 and more years, where he received the USSC Alumni Association's Distinguished Teaching Award, and he received that university's Innovations in Teaching Award. He's also a recipient of the prestigious Project Censored Real News Award. And Con is the author of an article that's up at my website, pacificfreepress.com, called 10 Myths About Libya, or 10 Myths About Libya, rejoinder. Now, Con, before we get to Professor Cole, I wonder, you in your article, you say that the Mediterranean has become essentially NATO's lake.
Right.
Every country bordering it is either in NATO or controlled by it. I did some research a while back when looking at Gaza, Palestine, and the offshore gas fields that Israel has taken the liberty uh-huh. of, and I looked across the whole of North Africa at rigs that were currently in the waters in the Mediterranean looking for oil or gas, but primarily gas, and what do you know? Every single country has rigs in the water. How about Libya? What's their situation? I mean, everybody's looking at the oil, but what about the gas resources?
Well, Libya has very large gas resources. I think the figure is 5 billion cubic yards. You know, that's a lot of gas. It's not anything like Iran, which has Iran and Russia have the two largest gas reserves in the world. But it's a substantial amount of gas, and there actually is a pipeline. A natural gas pipeline that goes across the Mediterranean directly to Italy. Italy is the major recipient of Libyan oil and gas. I mean, they were their colonial masters at one point. About 28% of oil and gas goes to Libya, about 15% to France, 10% to Germany, 10% to Spain, 11% to China, and then there's about 28%, which is spread out into different kinds of areas. You're quite right about the gas and oil in the Mediterranean, mainly gas. The last country at this point that borders the Mediterranean that doesn't have a formal, some kind of formal relationship with NATO, either being part of NATO or else being these associations which NATO runs, is Syria. That's the last one. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of tension right now between Israel and Lebanon over the question of where you draw the line for these gas reserves. And the Lebanese are saying, you know, you have to draw it here, and the Israelis are saying, no, you have to draw it here. And there's a lot of tension over that situation right there. So, you know, the U.S. Geological Survey 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, concluded that the world oil supplies had peaked. Now, there's some debate on that. There's some people who argue that isn't the case, but they make a pretty good argument for the fact that the oil reserves have now peaked. And so what we're starting to see is the slow decline of oil reserves. And when you look at the figures for North Sea oil, the Mexican oil, a lot of oil that is being pumped is, in fact, there's less of it. And there are new finds. There's a big, huge find off of Brazil, et cetera. But it does appear as if what's going to happen is that there's going to be a steady, maybe slow, but steady rise of the price of a barrel of oil. So in this case, given that this is the case, then, you know, having control of that energy high ground in the 21st century is something that, you know, any group of countries or any one particular country wants. And it's no accident that the United States is so deeply involved in the Middle East. 65% of the world's oil reserves are in the Middle East. And, you know, I find it kind of interesting that people dismiss this oil thing and they say, oh, well, you know, that's kind of, you know, that's old hat or that's sort of, you know, paranoid kinds of thing. I mean, it's really silly because, in fact, we do need oil. And if we don't get that oil, someone else is going to get that oil. And that's going to cost us more money. And one of the things that Libya did was is the fact that because oil went up, because of the Libyan war, that helped add to the economic distress in the United States. So if you're in the Obama administration, you're looking at an election in 2012, one of the things you want to do is to drive the price of oil down. I mean, that just makes common sense. And help the economy. Helping the economy means that you're going to lower the unemployment rate. Lowering the unemployment rate allows you to say we're in the midst of recovery going into the 2012 elections. I don't think the Obama administration invaded Libya because of the 2012 elections, but I know that was on some people's minds.
Well, yeah, timing is everything in these things. Well, Kong, we're fast running out of time. In the last couple of minutes, though, I want to get to your rebuttal of Professor Juan Cole. He's at the University of Michigan. He's a specialist in the Middle East, Iran primarily. His article, Top 10 Myths About the Libyan War, is the one that got you writing a rejoinder against Professor Cole's logic on this. What is it that Cole has wrong on this?
Well, you know, I kind of don't understand his article. I really was puzzled because, you know, I like Ron Cole and I read Ron Cole on a regular basis, and he's a very informed guy. And I thought of his arguments were just very odd. I mean, one of the things he says is he says, you know, the United States went into Libya because they support international law. But they don't support international law. And if they did, they would bring the Israelis up on charges for what they did in Operation Cast Lead in Gaza. They would demand that the same kind of criminal charges be filed against the leaders of Bahrain who've been oppressing Shiites. I mean, they're... You know, the United States supports international law when it's in its interest and ignores it when it's not in its interest. And you don't have to be, you know, you don't have to be a critic to say that. You just look at the record. The other thing he argues is that he says that the United States you know, has an interest in getting rid of despots. Well, listen, I'm perfectly willing to get rid of despots, but after they finish bombing Gaddafi, I assume then that the airplanes will go to Saudi Arabia and Bahrain, and, or for that matter, on to Myanmar. If we're in the business of overthrowing despots, I got a long list here, but we're not going to do that. We're not going to overthrow the monarchy in Bahrain because that's where the Fifth Fleet is parked. We're not going to take on the Israelis because the Israelis are a reliable ally in the Middle East. We're not going to take on Saudi Arabia, which is one of the most reactionary countries in the world, a complete monarchy, despots, because they're our allies. So that argument, just I was amazed that, you know, that he made it. And then the last thing he argues, he says, well, we have an interest in supporting NATO. Well, true, we have an interest in supporting NATO, but I don't have an interest in supporting NATO. I think NATO was created to confront the Soviet Union, and the Cold War's over. And what's NATO doing in Afghanistan? What's it doing in Libya? I think this is a military formation that has no place in the modern world at this point. I don't think NATO is in the interest of the people in NATO countries. We'll have to see military spending go on when their economies are in a recession. And I don't think that they're in the interest of the countries that they occupy. So, you know, I just felt there was a series of arguments, including this one very strange one, that somehow Libya was going to destabilize Egypt. How a country of 6.2 million people is going to destabilize a country of 83 million people? I don't get that.
Well, it's
and so
it's
when
really...
I read it, I just went through it, and I said, this is very sloppy thinking. I don't know why he wrote it, Chris. I really don't understand. He supported the initial invasion because he felt there were going to be massacres. I think his evidence is pretty thin on massacres. I think there have been some bad stuff on both sides. Again, I want to make it clear, I'm not a Gaddafi supporter. And I'm not going to lose any sleep at the fact that the man isn't running the country. On the other hand, you know, we don't know who's running the country here. And I think that, you know, Juan Cole sort of said, well, NATO didn't really play a big role here. Well, you know, of course we did. I mean, NATO is the reason why the rebels won that war.
Well, Con, sorry to cut in there, Con, but
I'd say you've got to go on to the next guest. Yeah,
we're right out of time, but Con Hallinan, you can find his website at Dispatches from the Edge, Con Hallinan, and you can see his stuff at Counterpunch. I'm going to come back. I'm going to be joined by Janine, and she's going to bring us up to speed with some of the local things going on, so do stick around for that.
When nothing is as it's presented.
It's a bit like discovering that your favorite uncle that's taken you for walks in the park, discover that he's really a serial abuser.
You need a different source. Guerrilla Radio on CFUV 101.9 FM and CFUV.ca. A century of news every Thursday and Saturday.
October 29th, the need for a transition to a plant-based food system in Canada. This is a workshop online hosted by Nation Rising. For the sake of Canadians' health, environmental commitments, and a desire to avoid inflicting unnecessary suffering and death on animals, Canada needs to transition to a plant-based food system. What will be the benefits of such a transition? How can it work? And how might various stakeholders make the most of the opportunities provided by this transition? So there's a panel of academics and policymakers. It's hosted on a Zoom platform. Tony Weiss is author of The Ecological Hoofprint, The Global Burden of Industrial Livestock and the Global Food Economy, The Battle for the Future of Farming. Sue Donaldson is co-convener of the Animals in Philosophy, Politics, Law, and Ethics Research at Queen's University. Will Kimlicka is the Canadian Research Chair in Political Philosophy at Queen's. Jordan Reichert, Deputy Leader of the Animal Protection Party of Canada. Andrew Fenton, Associate Professor in the Philosophy Department at Dalhousie. And Vasily Stanescu is Associate Professor of Communications at Mercer. So quite a panel. You can check it out on Facebook. Canada-Cuban relations in the time of Trump and COVID-19 also on Thursday at 4 p.m. It starts. It's online. Cuba's contribution to the global struggle against the COVID-19 pandemic has been held up as an example of success and solidarity, both internally and for their assistance to 42 countries worldwide. So this is a chance to listen to some speakers, members of parliament. There's the co-chair of Canadian Network on Cuba, and it's organized by the Canadian Network on Cuba, so you could go to their website for more information. Also on Thursday, How to Create a Vegan World, new skills and tools to take your vegan advocacy to the next level. Tobias Lehnert will be speaking in this webinar, and it's offered through Beyond Carnism, which works to create a more compassionate and just world for all beings, human and non-human alike. And then also another animal-related event at Monmouth University, Ending Speciesism in the Courts, a virtual event discussing cases like Tilikum versus SeaWorld with a PETA lawyer who works on behalf of the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. So chance to hear from them. Trail Building Day on Saturday, October 31st. They don't really say where. But trail building is usually a good thing. It means that roads, for example, are more difficult to build if there's people actually hiking in wilderness. So they have a Facebook page where you can email them at naturetrailsvolunteer@gmail.com. There's a TV outreach at Granville in Georgia. In Vancouver, an afternoon of speaking up for the animals. Meet outside the Vancouver City Centre SkyTrain station at 2 to screen modern farm and slaughterhouse footage and talk to bystanders about the importance of their food choices. And then they'll be going over to meet in Yaletown for food afterwards. Chinatown Sessions Halloween live stream on Saturday, October 31st. A variety show of a lifetime. They don't really have a lot of information, but it says everything from Victoria's most entertaining folks, from drag to rock and roll, a little bit of everything. So YouTube, check out Chinatown Sessions. On Sunday, Perfecting Liberation Legacies of Colonialism in Algeria and South Africa, Lessons for Palestine. It's the 66th anniversary of the start of the Algerian Revolution, the 103rd anniversary of the Balfour Declaration, and South Africa is labeled host to the world's greatest wealth gap. So looking at the successes and challenges of the Algerian and South African liberation struggles, the role of counter-revolutionary, neoliberal, and comprador classes in extending the legacies of colonialism. It's online. It's a Zoom session with panelists, Tufik Haddad, a Palestinian author, journalist, publisher, academic, and Naeem Jina, a South African academic, author, community leader, activist, Brahim Rouaba, Algerian political activist, organizer, and academic, and hosted by the Global Justice and Human Rights Law Network, the International Association of Democratic Lawyers, and the National Lawyers Guild. So check those out on Facebook. And that's what I got for this week. Thanks, Chris.
Well,
John Ross was an American journalist, poet, and author who lived in and reported from Mexico for more than three decades. Some of his many book titles include The Annexation of Mexico from the Aztecs to the IMF, One Reporter's Journey Through History, Mexico in Focus, A Guide to the People, Politics, and Culture, and his American Books Award-winning From the Roots, Indian Uprising in Chiapas, and Zapatista, Making Another World Possible, Chronicles 2000 to 2006. John Ross died last January in his beloved Mexico. I had a couple of opportunities to talk to John over the years, and before getting to our last chat, here's some of what his friend, Tim Redmond, a colleague at the San Francisco Bay Guardian, had to say about him. Quote, when John Ross left Terminal Island, the federal prison in Los Angeles, after serving a couple of years for refusing the Vietnam draft, the warden shook his head and said, Ross, you never learned how to be a prisoner. Well, I'm not writing the epitaph or whatever gravestone he has or doesn't have, wherever it might be in the world, but that's what I'd put on it. John Ross, 1938 to 2011, never learned how to be a prisoner. John was a poet, author, activist, agitator, and uncontrollable shit disturber, utterly and sometimes insanely fearless, pure of heart, and devoted to the cause of social justice so deeply that he could never let up, even for a minute. He was also my friend, and end quote. And that's from Tim Redmond, who worked with John Ross at the Bay Guardian in San Francisco. I spoke to John for the last time in August of 2008, and here's a bit of that interview. Well, welcome back to the program, John.
Hey, how you doing, Chris?
I'm doing all right. It's a beautiful, almost Mexican-like day up here in the Northwest. But, John, we're seeing a more muscular approach to U.S. policy in both Mexico and across Latin America. What do you think is behind this this revitalized approach to the South?
Good question. I think that a lot of that may have to do with the U.S. election, to tell you the truth. The Bush administration wants to leave something behind after completely forgetting about Latin America for a number of years, and has revived what you described accurately as a muscular policy in the region. And I think they want to get this in place before an Obama is elected. If a McCain is elected, he's a Navy guy, so he's going to be, I think, greatly in favor of employing a Fourth Fleet to keep Latin America in line.
Well, of course, Bush Sr., while he was president and as he was the effective president, as Reagan's vice president, was very much involved with Latin America, and most disturbingly so, as some of our older listeners may remember. Do you think that this is the influence of the Bush-Pair administration and some of the same personnel that Bush Jr. has taken on that is thinking it's time to revisit South America?
I'm not so sure, but it is an interesting coincidence that one of the ships that will be used in the revived Fourth Fleet, there's 11 more ships in the fleet, it's not confirmed yet, and indeed the aircraft carrier's not been commissioned, is a George H.W. Bush, and that will be homeported at Mayfort in Jacksonville, Florida, which is where the Fourth Fleet will be drawn from. The Fourth Fleet is not a standing fleet. It's drawn from the ships that are ported at in Jacksonville.
Yeah, well, now, you in your article, you talk about the Admiralty and their opinion, and one comment specifically is that, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but saying, well, this deployment will really, you know, show those other navies in the Caribbean and on the Atlantic seaboard what's what. A rather taunting
message. That was a curious statement, you know. It smacks of the Monroe Doctrine, no? And are we, is it a reference to, in fact, the navies of Latin America, or is it a reference to the possibility that other non-American nations will be cruising in those same waters, which is, in a real sense, and the Fourth Fleet is always, it's always reminiscent of those years of gunboat diplomacy that were justified by this obscure document issued in 1823, the Monroe Doctrine, that said, everybody else stay out of Latin America. Latin America is a U.S. lake.
So. Mm-hmm. Now, I know that amongst other things that the Bush administration might have lost sight of and lost, they're about to lose one of their half dozen naval bases in Latin America, and there's no indication that there might not be more to follow. So they've decided to set up
another base in Colombia in the south, right next door to Hugo Chavez. How are the Venezuelans reacting to the rumored prospect of this new base?
Hugo is not very happy. He called it an act of war when the Admiral Roughhead of the Fourth Fleet announced that the fleet was being reactivated. All around Latin America, the reactions of governments, basically governments on the left now, it was not very good. The State Department sent Tom Shannon, the Undersecretary of State for Hemispheric Affairs, on a tour of Latin America to try and convince leaders that this was a great idea and be in their interest to protect shipping lanes, that would be really good for drug interdiction and all of this stuff. He got to Brazil. There were big demonstrations in Brasilia, and when the concept of the reactivation of Fourth Fleet was put on the floor of the Brazilian Senate, there was a rebellion. One senator reminded his colleagues of 1964, when in fact the Fourth Fleet was stationed off of Brazil and invasion was threatened if a left-leaning president, João Goulart, did not resign. Those are the kind of memories that people have. The Fourth Fleet invokes memories of, we talked about the Caribbean as an American lake, where the Fourth Fleet was homeported on the island of Santo Domingo, which was a strategic point from which you could operate throughout the Caribbean, and carried the Marines and invaded Nicaragua, 14 times between 1914 and 1927? So, you know, the memories of what was in Latin America weigh a whole lot. You know, the imperialism has left its scars and it's left its memories, and indeed the resistance of the people keeps those memories alive.
Well, and you know, I guess when it comes to memory and amnesia, it's a lot easier to remember when you're on the receiving end of the stick, you know, to remember what had happened. And these imperial operators, they seem to have a convenient sense of amnesia where they can walk away from one like Nicaragua, as you imagine. More recent memory might be the mining of the harbors and the usurping of the left-leaning government there under Ronald Reagan. And when you mentioned the H.W. Bush as being the flagship of this Fourth Fleet, I can't help but wonder how that little bit of irony is received in Latin America as well.
Yeah, I you know, it is in a real sense, it is an offensive action. It is a provocative action, and it can come to no good. Let me put it that way. You know, you know, the Bush administration has been notoriously short-sighted in everything that's done over the last 8 years, and one might ask themselves if this is just some last desperate move on their part to, again, reassert their hegemony in Latin America. But the question is who, what comes next? And indeed, if things go the way people say they're going, I don't know, I live in Mexico, so I just hear rumors of elections in the United States, we'll certainly have a new president in November, and that new president will most likely be Barack Obama. And it is in the Bush administration's interest, and those ideologues, such as Cheney and the gang all around him, to put in place these policies and these strategic initiatives so that they will have to be, they will certainly be inherited by Barack Obama, and given his vacillation in one area of foreign policy after another, one would think that they have a good chance of surviving.
Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria, 104.3 on the cable, and CFUV.uvic.ca around the world in Shoutcast on the Internet. I'm speaking tonight with John Ross, and John Ross is an American journalist, poet, and author who's lived in and reported from Mexico for more than three decades, and some of his book titles include The Annexation of Mexico, From the Aztecs to the IMF, One Reporter's Journey Through History, Mexico in Focus, A Guide to the People, Politics, and Culture, and his latest book is Zapatista Making Another World Possible, Chronicles 2000 to 2006. John, about the Zapatistas now, Plan Mexico has been announced up here, something similar to those that are familiar with Plan Colombia, but it seems that the Mexicans are fated for the same kind of horrific treatment the Colombians have suffered under Plan Colombia. How is this affecting Chiapas and the Zapatista movement, John?
Well, we haven't seen any evidence of Plan Mexico as yet. It was just signed into law by Bush on June 30th, and then Michael Chertoff, head of Homeland Security, was in the country on July 19th. It is interesting that right after Chertoff was here, this story leaked that drug gangs in the state of Sinaloa, which has been in horrific convulsions for months, 500 people have been killed since the first of the year. In the state of Sinaloa, a car bomb factory was alleged to have been found. And the Drug Enforcement Administration, this is on the day that Chertoff left, put out a story saying that the drug cartels, Sinaloa drug cartels, were sending their elite hitmen, terrorists, through Venezuela to Iran for training. No, a preposterous story, but given the way that Plan Mexico is worded and what it's supposed to do, given its insertion, it folds into the thing that in Mexico called the ASFAN. It's got other initials in the north, which is the Agreement on Security and Supposed Prosperity.
The SPP
for North America.
Yeah.
It is. It's really, it's a NAFTA for security and for energy. It integrates the security structures and the energy structures, which is really what they'd like to get at, into one three-country alliance, no? And it has plenty to do with Canada. I'm sure there's been a lot of talk about it up in Canada. But under ASFAN, in terms of security forces, the U.S. will have the option of being able to send troops into Mexico. Mexico also represents the southern perimeter, the southern security perimeter, as defined by the U.S. North Command, the NORCOM in Colorado, which is responsible for the defense of the United States from the United States mainland from outside terrorists, no? And that also apparently gives the United States the ability to put troops in Mexico. No one is saying that this is going to happen, and indeed the United States has put a lot of troops in Mexico down the years. It's invaded Mexico 9 times since Mexico won its liberation from Spain in 1821. And it is a hot potato to talk about putting U.S. troops on the ground here in the drug war or in the terror war or whatever the pretext is for exerting its authority over Mexican security forces.
Yes, well, John, it's called the Security and Prosperity Partnership, the SPP for in English, and yes, it's drawn some criticism in Canada, and yes, earlier in the year, bureaucrats working outside of the parliament, actually within the military, within the two militaries, signed a similar agreement that for the first time allows that American law enforcement and military be deployed in Canada and vice versa in the event, if I'm remembering the quote, of social unrest or disaster or calamity or something to this effect. Of course, Canada can only boast being invaded by the United States 4 times, not like Mexico's 9. But no, it's not going over well here, but fortunately we have a supine media that rarely reports. In fact, our Prime Minister, the minority Prime Minister Stephen Harper, was in my little town just hours ago to celebrate this province's 150th birthday and was speechifying and whatnot and was heckled by people unknown. And you know, it seems that no matter how many Canadians are against this SPP, it's going to go through. Has there been demonstration in Mexico against the Spanish
there
enactment?
There's been a lot of talk. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a lot of ways of dealing with this thing. For example, what probably the driving social movement in the country and the driving social mobilizing force in the country is this battle against the privatization of the petroleum industry. Mm-hmm. Which is now on the floor of the Senate, and there have been massive demonstrations and will continue to be massive demonstrations. A referendum was held last week. A couple million people voted against.
Oh, did I lose you, John?
The the ASPAN, because, you know, one of the parts of the ASPAN is integrating energy resources of the three countries, you know. And in order to be able to do that, you need to have a certain amount of force to be able to let it be known that that oil belongs to Uncle Sam. And that's where the use of the Fourth Fleet, and it's all within the purview of the Fourth Fleet, use of the Fourth Fleet and the use of actual ground troops or civilian mercenaries, which have been all the style in this thing, comes in.
Well, now there's another aspect to these relations between Mexico and the United States, and how this all ties up with, of course, the three nations, Canada being being the third. It's the Merida Initiative that was signed the end of June. Now, what is this just another name for Plan Mexico, or is there more to it?
Plan Mexico is actually another name for the Merida Initiative. The initiative was signed in Merida in 2007, the first meeting between Bush and Bush came to Mexico. It was the first meeting between Bush and Calderon here. Calderon had just declared this massive mobilization of the military against the drug cartels, 30,000 troops in the field. And the idea was essentially to, we've called it Plan Mexico after Plan Colombia for a long time, and God knows I may be the guy that coined that. But there are certain distinctions. This is basically a subsidy to the U.S. defense contractors. Mexico gets no money, but they get a lot of equipment. A lot of this equipment is secondhand equipment. Some of it is Black Hawk helicopters. The Navy gets a bunch of stuff. It comes to, if in fact the three installments are paid, they've only voted on the first installment, they'll come to about $1.4 billion. The first installment, it's just $400 million. In this day and age, $400 million is, quickly spent. But they've done some things here that are kind of interesting. One has been, some of this money has been contracted out and paid already by the State Department to what is the name of Vivant Industries in New York State, which installs surveillance systems, voice identification systems, so that without warrants, much like George Bush, the Mexican government is now able to listen in, probably listening in on this conversation, and audit everyone's emails in the country. So there's a first. There's the first example of what Plan Mexico America Initiative is going to do. Although I don't believe that the intelligence gathering is part of the monies that were allocated.
Well, yeah, this is of course one of the areas that Blackwater said it wanted to get into, getting out of its direct duties as it's seen them in Iraq and in Louisiana, and going into more of an a freebooting intelligence service.
Well, I think that's true. One of the things that Blackwater's just got a contract for from the Department of Defense was to build a blimp, one of these drug warning blimps. There's been a bunch of them floated along the border, but for some reason they had a better design, and they got a big chunk of money from the Department of Defense. That was another indication that they were definitely headed into the drug war business.
Well, has there been any indication in Mexico that this drug war that's been going on forever, it seems, has made any effects on organized crime or the drug importation coming out of or through Mexico?
Yeah, sure. The second in command of what amounts to the Justice Department here was fired today, and the third in command was fired yesterday. So there's two immediate effects. It's been just a fracaso. There are over 4,000 people dead, and this year's rates are so incredible that I can't report on it anymore, and I don't like to report on it because that's pretty much what the U.S. news media and big commercial media seems to be attuned to. Mexico is two things: it's immigration and it's the drug war. But there's no getting around the fact that the drug violence in this country is cresting all the time, and that there are whole cities now in the north along the border and deeper in that are now controlled by the cartels. The attempts to put 30,000 troops into the field has resulted in many cases, in massive human rights abuses. In other cases, corruption of the military. And this old pattern that's happened here before, other presidents have tried to do the same thing. And it just happens over and over again in terms of you get a whole new set of officers, you replace every police officer in the country, and within 6 months, everyone's done the take again. So, you know, that doesn't seem to work. And when it comes to drugs in this country, there's only one solution in terms of trying to deal with that, and that is to just forget it and legalize the drugs and, you know, move on to something that has something to do with social responsibility.
Yeah, well, sadly, I don't think that's even close to happening. Well, John, we're fast running out of time, but I don't want to leave it. But you mentioned in your article Brad Wills, and Brad Wills was killed in Oaxaca City. God, what was it now? Two years ago now?
October 2006. Yeah.
And they're still clamoring from his supporters in the United States and trying to get some resolve. He was killed by Mexican security forces, shot. Well, he was unarmed. He was shooting.
I ran a story last August that ran, I think, 25 papers here, alternative papers. We published the pictures of people that killed him. Mm-hmm. You know. They're not hard to get. They were in all the Mexican newspapers. There has been no move on the part of authorities in Oaxaca, no moves on the part of the federal authorities, no moves on the part of the U.S. Embassy to press the investigation of this case. The case is essentially in the cold case file. But it had a whole lot to do with the passage of Plan Mexico in the U.S. Congress. Indeed, Brad's friends, group of people that have... that worked with him in New York and were part of his activist movement and, you know, longtime friends, and went to Congress and said, look, you can't pass this unless, you know, there are some stipulations in here pressing the investigation of Brad's past. And they got thrown out of Congress, but Patrick Leahy in the Senate did hear them, and I think other congressmen heard them, and there was a stipulation in Plan Mexico that they be intensified investigation into the death of Brad Will. We don't know what that means. What, you know, there's been no investigation now. So, but nonetheless, it is in the final language of the Plan Mexico Merida initiative, and it is an issue that I think the journalists and activists all over the world, and certainly in the three North American free trade countries, should be working on. This guy was killed doing his job on the barricades in Oaxaca, and no one, least of all the United States State Department, has raised a finger in his defense.
Yeah, just another dead journalist shot. He actually filmed his own murder. Well, John, before we go, you've got another one in the works, El Monstruo, Tales of Dread and Redemption in the Most Monstrous Megalopolis on Planet Earth. I'm assuming that's Mexico City.
That's a working title.
So
it's the left history of Mexico City. And I think, I'm learning a lot writing it. So it's to me, it's writing these books are always learning experiences. And I'm learning a lot of history here and learning a lot about how cities operate as well. So it's been an exciting book to write.
Well, you certainly picked
it'll be out in, I think it'll be out in the fall of 2009 if I'm still alive.
Well, you certainly picked an interesting city. And for those of you that want to read more of John's journalistic works, he's often published up at counterpunch.org. Thanks a lot, John, for coming back on the show.
Okay, thank you, Chris.
All right. Bye. Good night.
Starts. Sometimes the only thing